Welcome to the So-and-So series, readings by early career poets.
It happened last night. I gave a reading last night, and it was more Sam heckling than my actual work. Thank you for coming. This is the 27th So-and-So series. There will be three more here in Boston, and then infinite more in North Carolina. Seriously?
You're moving to North Carolina?
I am. Well, how do you work your camera, Sam?
You gotta open it first.
I know. That's what I meant by work.
Pull the thing up.
Does that work?
Jeez.
Whoa, is it zoomed in?
Are you taking a picture of yourself?
Are you taking a picture of
me? I can't tell. It's hard to say. Oh, yeah, that worked.
You can go in and out.
Let's not get lewd, Sam. Nice. Lewd. Excellent. Okay. Okay. What's the name of the artist besides his Bartleby? Who is showing in at the Tate Modern in London. Did the broadside for this evening. But he decided to go by Bartleby, so keep that hush hush. So please check out, we have I think four from this season, four broadsides, which are triptychs this season, if you care to separate them in three different frames, blah blah blah, and then of course all of last season, which is up on this thing, and for that we have Mary and, where's Bob? Bob, if you've met Bob, thank them, and also them and Trisha for allowing us to have the reading in their living and working space. It'll be August 23rd, is that possible? August 23rd?
It's a day.
That is a day in August. And that will be Summer Browning, Hazel McClure, Summer Browning from Brooklyn, Hazel McClure from Buffalo, and Aaron Teager right from here in Boston, or actually Cambridge or Somerville or wherever he lives. And then there will be two more in Boston in October, and then that will be it.
Boo.
Yep, gotcha. All right, well, let's get started. Do I have anything else to say? Raleigh. Yeah. Where there are not that many reading series, I feel like, so we'll see what happens. We're just going to go in alphabetic order, if that's okay with everybody. Yeah? Everyone? Hello, so-and-so reader Bronwyn Tate, who we are big fans of. Elizabeth Bradfield is the author of... This is Smudge, so excuse me if I mess this up. I didn't memorize it, oddly enough. Elizabeth Bradfield is the author of interpretive work by Arctois Books. Is that even close?
Arctois.
Arctois Books. Red Hen Press, 2008, and editor of www.broadsidedpress.org, who sadly just got rejected by AWP for a panel that we were going to work with her on. But they apparently don't like interesting panels. Which Broadsided, which is a virtual grassroots press that harnesses the tradition of the broadside to put words on the Boston Institution, but sold out and moved to D.C. Poetry in anthologies and are forthcoming in Plowshares, still a Boston Institution, and Orion. Her second book, Ice Blink, will be published in late 2009. A recent transplant from Alaska, where you recently were, is that true? She lives in North Truro. When not writing, she works as a naturalist. Elizabeth Bradfield.
Hi. Thanks for coming. This is such an amazing space. I'm really excited to be here. So I'm going to read a little hodgepodge from some from the book and some from other stuff. But we were driving in tonight from the Cape and talking about being in South. And there was a little boat in Provincetown that sank this last year called the Chico Jess. And it actually started here in Boston as a Sicilian fishing boat. They dragged around and then ended up on Cape Cod and dragged around there, fished for a lot of different stuff, and sank recently and inspired this poem. So let me find it. It's called In the Inner Harbor. You can still stand in the case of the mast and the radar sticking up from it. Pilot house and deck aglow that shifts with light, tide, and the seasons of plankton. Some say scuttled, but maybe just the natural fate of an old boat that's worked itself to rust and rot by working the waters through their fish. Either way, it's tied now to the pier where it sank, ringed by orange containment booms, still moored between the Carol Ann and Jersey Princess. Off the wharf's end, gannets feed. They soar with one eye tipped to water, then stall, fold wings, javelin, the water shot through, bodies pulling the silver air down, trajectory as guy wires. Aglow in the blue-green water, wings held half open, bubbles of sky clinging, no motion or effort to it, they rise, shake the water from themselves, having traveled to the other world, fed. The Chico Jess doesn't rise, though we want it to. This ghost of a time when we salivates, who should foot the bill of its removal? The gannets, hunting among the moorings and pilings of the inner harbor, rise through water we once feared would erase us, and now hope might manage it. There's something magic happening. So I have some list-ish poems and some other, and I'm going to read one that kind of bridges the two. It's called Concerning the Proper Term for a Whale Exhaling. And I mentioned a couple things in the poem. One is a town called Huna, which is a small little space, little native community, province town, a glittering Cape Cod town. And it is very true that if you work on the water, they do call humpback whales domps. Concerning the proper term for a whale exhaling. Poof, my mother sighs, as against the clear-cut banks near Huna, another humpback exhales, its breath white and backlit by sun. Don't say that, said disapproving of such casual terminology, or uneasy with the tinge of pink tulle, the flounce poof attaches to the thing we're watching, beast of hunt, of epic migrations. But I'm the naturalist, suggesting course and speed for approach. They are novices, and the word is mine, where we docked each night after a day of watching whales. Poof. Todd or Lumby would gutter, turning the helm, my cue to pick up the microphone. Coming from those smoke-ruffed cynics who call the whales dumps, rank the tank-top talent on the bow, and say each time they set a breaching calf in line with the setting sun, now what do you think of that? Now that's... Then sit back, light a cigarette. Coming from them, I loved the word. And even more, because the dock we returned to each night teemed with summer crowds, men lifting their hands to other men, the town flooded with poofs, free to flutter, to cry, as they can't in Newark or Pittsburgh, or to linger and glow for a brief time visible. This little list here. It's like a little program. Living up in Alaska, we had these areas that were called multi-use areas. Do we have seen them here? I don't think so. Different. So, yeah, it's different. So it's kind of like a refuge, kind of like go shoot some stuff, drive your four-wheeler, anything you want to do, just don't build anything.
Can you log?
You can't log. You can't do any extract. Well, in some multi-use areas, there are some extraction activities, but usually it's just land that you can. So you get like Audubon bird tours, and then, you know, dudes on their four-wheelers, all at the same place. It's a really interesting little convergence. So this poem is called. It takes place in Alaska, and it's called Multi-Use Area. With the day on the hay flats, sun slight through clouds. Grasses, just starting again from last year's grasses, geese and crane marsh, have been better without the old tires, the gutted couch in a pullout, a moose slumped alongside, meat taken but the head still attached. I can close my eyes to the pop bottles, booze bottles, and orange skeet shells in the parking lot, along the river, walk past them. I can pretend I close my ears. There, a white-fronted goose. There, a pintail, willow branches cracking underfoot, F-14s from the base, and there, again, the shotgun blast and whoop, which I can't edit out, which I probably shouldn't. It stops when I walk into view, I stop and stare across the flats through my binoculars, thinking, ass. Someone staring back at me over a truck bed, thinking, asshole. That's Alaska in a little... It's anywhere in a little nugget, I think. So in this book, it kind of goes back and forth between... I wanted to call the... So I ended up calling it interpretive work, and it goes back and forth between naturalist-based poems and then poems that are more about being interpreted. And, gosh, we lived on Cape Cod before moving to Alaska, and I never thought I would write poems about sexuality and being interpreted as queer in the world. That wasn't my interest or subject, but living in a town, it became very interesting to me. So... this poem, there's a series of poems called the Butch Poems in this book, and this is called Butch Poem 4, Losing a Father. With him, something left her, some hook by which she gaffed the world and held it to sense, to love, to law. His best son, at his side, she cleared gutters of leaves, shoveled the drive, changed the Chevy's oil, sat back after dinner, heavy in a chair. She learned to be a gentleman. Hard at first for him to see her tapping out his cigarettes, wearing his old belt and shoes, to see what she took as her own. He came again to love even what rested silent between them, and she knew her luck. But when he died, some of her swagger, some of her bull-headed sureness, some hope to be praised for the likeness she'd made was shaken. I have no metaphors to lend this, just witness to her decentering. Just certainty that almost could be more difficult. I'm just going to read a couple, maybe just one more from the book, New Things. This is another one of the Butch poems. It's called Butch Poem 6, A Countertenor Sings Handel's Messiah. Do all of you know what a countertenor is? I didn't until I had this experience. It's I think it becomes evident in the poem, so I won't tell. It's amazing sound. And there are lines lifted directly from the Messiah in the poem, and I'm not going to do any of this, but I think it'll be obvious from the diction. Butch Poem 6, A Countertenor Sings Handel's Messiah. 7 verses in, he has stepped out from the tuxed and taffeted quartet of soloists. He has begun to sing. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and shall call his son Emmanuel. Amplified by good acoustics, the hall is rustling accompaniment to the countertenor's solo. Lift up thy voice with strength. Lift it up. Be not afraid. Arise, shine, for thy light is come. From my seat next to my parents, high toward the program, small lights coming on above the paper. My parents restrain themselves, but the rest of the hall is turning to the biography, is lifting opera glasses, is straining ears to hear him. Then shall the eyes of the blind be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. He is singing the alto's part in her key, his voice whispering underscores the music. What is this high, sweet voice in a tuxedo? I am transfixed. I want to reach under his starched shirt front and find a different sex. Listen to him. He was despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. He hid not his face from shame. Through these old words, he is making song of the drag queen and the bull dyke. Let him sing without the accompaniment of rustle. Let him sing without any doubt between body and voice. High, but not shrill, more lovely than the wide-skirted soprano, the chunky tenor, the dapper bass. I watch his shine-parted hair at key change. Thou art gone up on high. Thou hast led captivity captive and received gifts for men. Afterward, in the bar, where anemones splay open and salmon flick through canals designed for our wonder, no one mentions the countertenor. My parents, I think, are trying to nail all I can think of. His rolled R's, Adam's apple lifting his tie at crescendo. on stage, then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. Billed as high culture, on stage, this unsettlement, this beauty, applauded at last. I have all these plans. I was going to read a couple, because it's hot, of poems about icy places, but I think instead I'll just end with one more from the book. So when we moved to Anchorage in a little townhouse, like everybody else, and there were a lot of kids in the neighborhood, which was kind of a new experience for me as well, and this poem came from their tortures. It's called Cul-de-sac Linguistics. Today, the boys call each other penis. Hey, penis. Come here, penis. Pass me the ball, penis. Last week, it was whore. Discovered halfway on the mini hoop that backs my fence. And earlier this afternoon, the teenage girls, whose bedroom window stares above my thumbnail yard, improvised outgoing messages in theatrical rapture. First, the easy scatological, then a nursery rhyme that morphs into an anti-homo riff so suddenly I actually look up, reading poetry as my girlfriend weeds the flower bed. Oh, the high profanity of kickball games, the rough posturing demanded by even this tame street. Listen, they're learning how well bastard fits with fucking, how ass can't be misused. No one could hope to ease their jagged entries into this profane world, which is fucking beautiful. Ass-bast evening light wild and soaring like kickballs on a true arc into flower beds of penis tulips and pussy daffodils that nod their heads in wild agreement with the whorish, shit-loving lot of it. Thanks.
Thank you, Liz. Our second reader is Kevin Gallagher. He is the author of two chapbooks of poetry, Isolate Flex by Servina Barva Press, and Looking for Lake Texcoco, is that right? By Sigist, forthcoming next. His poetry and reviews have appeared in such publications as The Boston Review, Emergency Almanac, Green Mountains Review, Harvard Review, Jacket, Piecework, The Partisan Review, and elsewhere. In 2004, he edited a feature on Kenneth Rexroth for Jacket, and a chapbook titled Nevertheless, Some Gloucester Writers and Artists. From 1992 to 2002, he was a publisher and editor of Compost, I'm going to mess this name up,
Bazooka.
Margaret Bazooka, sweet, is titled There's No Place on Earth Like the World, from Zephyr. 2006. He is now guest editing a feature on Denise Levertov for Jacket. He lives with his wife Kelly and son Theo in Newton, Massachusetts. Kevin Gallagher.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks, Ansel, for putting this together and having me here. And Super, thanks to Ropadope. That's to you folks, to the broadsides, those are incredible. Thanks so much, and thank all you folks for coming. I'm going to read a handful of poems from my first chapbook called Isolate Flex, and then a couple from the new thing. As if in a cocoon, a woman sways on a hammock surrounded by hanging purple lilacs. A Cleopatra in a dove's wing with dangling grapes. I lounge with my feet up on my desk, thinking about my scene and acting out hers all day long, is echoed by the hole in my black sock. Drive-by. I sat cross-legged, swinging on my swing, feeling less alive than a marionette. The neighbor's children danced under the sunset, pulling each other's hair, so I wasn't surprised when the bullet hit my head. I was too busy smiling. I smiled when they put me in the casket. I smiled when they lowered me under my stone. It took my death to bury my hatchet. The roots around me remind me of my bones. They shot the living daylights out of me. I can't see. You can't see me, but I be. Red Sox won tonight? Do you know if the Red Sox won tonight?
They got crushed.
Two in a row. Well, This is a Red Sox retro pro sonnet. It's called Louis Tiant Fan Club Alumni. Although Freddie will always be sour that his sister went and traded his tops Ted Williams and Roberto Clemente for a box of stupid beer every inning, every Sunday he could at Fenway Park from 1975 to 1985. After warming up for a few innings, he'd stand up in the middle of the row and scream, "Dominoes!" Then laugh as one person after another had to pop up to let him get up for another pair. This sonnet is dedicated to tourists in Gloucester, Massachusetts. It's called Tiny Little Drinking Village with a Fishing Problem. I'm the only one in the house that works, yet I'm the one who's turning 70. Daughter got knocked up when she was 15, then the dope that stung her moved right in once we got the kid back from the state. Whatever his name was working until this girl and the new kid move in too. On top of that, he's got two dogs he won't walk, so I make him shit out back. So you think I care when the neighbor calls to tell me his wife can't stand the dog shit and they want to express their concern that they heard someone in my house last night screaming, "Next time, I'm going to kill you." This poem's called Inri, I-N-R-I. Yes, I would tug on Mom's dress, point to the insignia above the cross, and proclaim, "I know what that means, Ma." Overwhelmed with my interest in the Lord, she would crouch down and whisper, "What? Made in Rhode Island." She'd squeeze my hand and do a lap around the rosary. The women would roll ravioli for a week, then serve it on Sunday after church. When he was done, the other men would join him in the living room, pants unbound. The women would drink coffee and clean. One night, when Nana was bathing me, I pointed between my legs and screamed, "This is my penis!" She ignored me, covered my mouth, and launched right into "This little piggy went to market" on my toes. But I pointed back to her and said, "And you have a vagina!" "No, I don't," she said. We do things here because that's the way they were done in the old country, where almost everyone drove a Fiat. When Fiat started marketing to us here, we drove them thinking Federal Hill was Rome, until they started to break down at every turn, and we renamed Fiat "Fix It Again, Tony." One more poem from... it's called Composition in Blue, Noir, et Rouge. Freddie went to New York City to see the big Piet Mondrian exhibit. It was his wife's idea, but he loved it. "There's no better place I'd rather be," he assured her. She was worrying that he was wearing a smile but having a fit. It had been years since she had seen him sit in anything in front of a TV for more than 15 minutes. But he sat in front of the same 40-inch painting for the whole afternoon. She thought, "What in heaven's name is that man thinking?" He later remarked he felt right at home that day. "It was like I was watching a game in the emergency station identification colors." All right, these poems are more serious. This is for all of you today, but such is the world of small presses. It's called Looking for Lake Texcoco, and it's a series of poems that are in an abstract way, a reaction to a famous Mexican painting by a Mexican painter named Juan O'Gorman. And it shows an indigenous person holding a map of Mexico City, which used to be a tiny little island surrounded by this Lake Texcoco, while the are the architects who are building Mexico City into the city that it is now of 27 million people. Against the grain. Wake up, wake up. Oh, and one interesting thing, the cool thing about this book is that I wrote this in English. That's my first language. But Guillermo Parra, who's translated the book into Spanish, so it's going to be a bilingual book. And we think it's the first book published, written by a gringo and translated into Spanish. Usually books that are bilingual here, are written by someone who writes in Spanish as a first language and translated into English. But we could be wrong, but it's part of the marketing strategy.
Is he living in North Carolina?
Did he move down?
Is
it? Is Guillermo down there?
I think he is.
It's all a myth. It might not be the same. It is Guillermo Parra, and it might not be the first book like that. It's all part of the marketing strategy. Big stuff. Okay. Three poems from this book, only in English. Against the Grain. And the moon has set. 10,000 years is much too old. Leave the milpa. Jobs will glow on cacti in the desert and in the gold hotels. The ruins underneath were named so for a reason. The maize came like a torrential rain, flooding markets with foreign grains. Those who stayed burned compact discs for pirates selling Britney Spears for 10 pesos. Those who stayed learned to solder copper wire into printed circuit boards and take pregnancy tests. They later came to know they did not know why they were asked to leave again. Those who stayed sow seeds and trade for chickens. Those who leave wash my dishes, pick my fruit, paint my house, and send money home. This poem is called Colonia Valle. The moon lamps an amber bottle of beer. The wind, an owl skimming over them. Are there more dogs on these roofs than stars in the sky? There are more cars than dogs. There are two hands for every dog. They applaud each new day by clapping corn into morning tortillas, lie scattered like struck bowling pins. This poem's called Guanajuato Ritual, and in rural Mexico, there's a tradition. If for some tragedy your young child dies, you have a huge party for the child, and you sit the child at the head of the table, and you have a huge party around him. And then when everybody funds on a portrait taking of you and your dead child. And this is called Guanajuato Ritual. The rain is thin silver chain. Candles, white doves with halo beaks that dot broken window eyes. We let you clasp your favorite doll for the last family portrait. We seat you at the head of the table. We party. Teapots steam little locomotives. Calla lilies, angels waving goodbye. This is the poem that Rope-a-Dope turned into the broadside. It's called Under an Evangelical Billboard That Reads Try My God. Evangelism is sweeping Latin America. It's an indigenous religion, and evangelism is huge. Wherever you go, you see these huge billboards, Jimmy Swaggart, all this stuff. It's quite interesting. The selva is a forest. And milpa are the fields where they grow things. And when peasants are growing things, you usually burn to do what you need to do.
And here is Tree Rollins.
And Tree Rollins is mentioned in this poem.
Thank you,
anyone know who Tree Rollins is? You folks are from the
Basketball Center,
Atlanta Hawks.
Yeah.
Lots of peasants live in all of our secondhand clothing. And you see David Third kill and way out of... Jerry, Tree Rollins was actually in the news. He just got fired. He was the coach of a WNBA team. Got fired last week. A man in a Tree Rollins Hawks tank top, no shoes, in your old Sassoon, drops one match on the selva side of the road. Fire with a smoke mane flaps the wind and stunk block. Wood is gathered. The milpa is a charred, thin veil, but the Trinity will come. Maize, frijoles, and calabaza. Frijoles and calabaza are beans and squash. And those are esperanza, or faith and hope. Isais's pupils contracted to the point where it was hard to see whenever he looked north. He'd seen Dallas, Dynasty, and Cheers. He hoped he wouldn't be like Sanford's son. Would his hair mane blonde but stand still when his head turned round? His wife kissed, his roll of money, his clothes on. He lived south of Reynosa, his walk there was free. His hand met many others, his returned empty, theirs returned green. He entered a windowless van. For 4 hours he rode 4 blocks away to the riverbank. Isais rose his head to see cranes wing to his dreams in 2 flaps. He took his clothes and let him dive into the river. Isais and the river swam brown. Isais washed up on his 50-yard dream, exhausted and freckled with bloodsuckers. But he popped each sucker off from his skin as if it was the cap of a bottle of champagne. Through the thicket he saw parking lots he was told of. Their windshields were a field of jewels. He was here. Their owners were hearing loud music, seeing big churches, not daring to eat anything, but taking lots of pictures. Naked, he dragged himself under the sea of cars, popping his head out, looking left, then right, using each car as a turtle shell, then slinking to the next. He rolled under an open-bottom van. He pulled himself up and was handed... It's a last poem. It's called Natives. A pumpkin head with a bamboo backbone, overalls and red high tops, has a potbelly of hay. In file supporting him are droves of green legions, armed and of corn. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. Our last reader, John, a Journal of Contemporary Poetry and Poetics, and Free Verse Editions, a new poetry series, which you should really check out. It's some of my favorite poets, Tom Lisk, Adam Clay, Morgan Lucas Schultz, put out books on Free Verse Editions, so please check that out. As well as Free Verse, it's a fantastic online journal. His first volume of poems, The Book of the Floating, appeared in a new expanded edition in 2007. He recently finished a new collection of poems called Strange Country. John Thompson.
Thanks, Chris, for the nice plug there, and thanks for having me read here, and thanks to everybody who made this possible. I'm going to, and this is a collection of poems that's loosely based on photographs of Japan during the American occupation. The photographs were taken by my father, and I sort of rediscovered them after his death. So this is a collection of poems that, in immediate sense, is about loss. But it's also to get at sort of the larger connections between the present and the past, about violence, about representation, and the ethics of witness. What does it mean to photograph an occupied country, about an occupied country? So the epigraph from the collection is from the Zen master Dogen. Time goes from present to past, which is sort of a hard line to follow. But the first poem I'm going to read is called Thresholds, and it's a photograph of a photographer photographing a temple door in Japan. So in your mind's eye, you sort of have to reconstruct it. There's my father, who's photographing someone, photographing a temple. And again, the poem's called Thresholds. In a long, thick rope, the officer, looking into his viewfinder, has approached its threshold as a stranger beholding a strange place without God or gods. Stopped before its dim interior, he wants to capture its foreignness for the future. He is still before the folding doors of the entrance he is looking in, to take away the image of the tall brass incense tree, the story of ascending smoke, which is his story, a story in which he does not exist, of the photographer does not exist, a story in which the eye that writes these lines does not exist. A story in which the photo fades with the smoking tree. A story in which the story gets in the way of the story. This poem is called Writing History, and it takes off from a photograph of a working class woman who's what appears to be dusk. Writing history. If everything becomes everything else, if every event touches every other event, creates it, reverberates through and beyond it, then nothing is inconsequential. And history, what we are and what we are becoming. A continuous making and unmaking, a story of unspeakable intimacy and unspeakable loss. Here is a photograph of winter and dusk and train tracks. someone who has passed out of one history into another where the blanks are unfillable. We know so little, but on that we base everything. And the photographer who is about to take her photograph, he does not know her. Her reasons, his own. This man who became the photograph I now hold in my hand. How the blanks and spaces fill the years. How much the body, the tired body, the photographed body, the figuratives that loom larger, longer, wider. What was it you saw when you glanced up at him, that man who lived in a world which still thought the world was all in the things you could see? I'll read one more from the collection here. It's the closing poem in the collection. It's called From the Ship, a Coastline. And the image that the poem is based on is just that, as you'll be able to tell shortly, which is really about leave-taking, a number of different kinds of leave-takings. And I begin with one of the most beautiful languages, one of the most beautiful poems in any language that I know, Wallace Stevens' poem, Waving Adieu, Adieu, Adieu. From the Ship, a Coastline. That would be waving, and that would be crying, crying and shouting, and meaning farewell. But there could be neither waving nor shouting, even if everything was a way of saying farewell, without saying it. Farewell in the eyes, farewell in the hands, farewell in the words, the inchoate, half-legible words, the rasped-out words, a different alphabet for a different world. The words, the pencil traced, the torn words, words that could not be seen, torn words fluttering down, words of petition, words I have only words. Will you do this? Death words, balm words, the words in the eyes pleading, the old duty. Heaven itself, a way of crying and shouting and meaning farewell. So I'm going to read some poems from a collection that I've just finished. I'm calling it Strange Country. I'm reading a few poems, or prose poems. Threaded throughout these poems are some words and phrases from this marvelous English poet Edward Taylor, who came to the States in the 17th century, obviously before it was the States. And these are used to sort of connote something of the passion and fervency of his own American experience, and also a righteousness which I think is timely now. The first poem I'm going to read is simply called 20. It's a poem which is interested in thinking about genocide and the words that we use to refer to genocide or to not refer to genocide. So this is poem 20. It took off from a story I heard a while back about Juari, but didn't find it there. No book, no masters, no memory. A mob runs riot in the blood, and everywhere loud singing. The sanctuaries are choirs undone. Open the red flood, that congregation alway cometh surging. The painter lies who pencils death's face grim, with white, bare butter teeth, bare staring bones. Disheveled and so richly piled, and with purple vestments laid down. Man palms his ears and moans, but moans not loud and hears not at all. Knows he better? Better to not speak the word, word of fig, with neither possession nor passion. Say what will be said, that which was missaid. Say a body where none. This poem is simply called 16. Again, it's a poem sort of thinking about contemporary experience in terms of our history. But where is the enemy coming from? Amid wandering madmen and visionaries, there are visions which compel, and to defy them is senseless raving. But how it came amazeth all communion. Beyond the border, they have always been beyond the border. Campaigns in other lands, binding with cord both subjects and objects. Whisper and hush. Bitter glottals barely sounded never will be heard. Never ending this epic and scarcely felt. Figures to be forgotten. And then April draws near. The sweetness of sun in spring on grass is death. This poem's called 23, and I think it's called the No Sanctuary exhibit, which was an exhibit of photographs of people lynched in the late 19th century and 20th century up until about 1940. Shocking exhibit. Arrived at a place mute of light, sunlight and darkness apparitional, the wild chiaroscuro of black and white resolved in still lifes to the terror of sheer verticality and the galleries of glad eyes. Sure angels stare, such rugged looks and ragged robes. Heaved. Having heaved last prayers, the black faces hang open to heaven, their bodies relics of the soul, kneeling communicants standing in midair. However they suffered and died, whatever rents did to flesh, in solitude they came to the innocence of trees, which could not but enjoin them in their going. A place are blanks, souvenirs not past collecting. This last poem is from a different sequence, from a sequence of poems on Jackson Pollock's paintings. So the title here comes from a famous Autumn Rhythm. The dream has reappeared. Everything in brown, black, and white. The migration is white, crawl and surge. Strange that we have been on the journey so long without talking about it. That joy is always a leave-taking, a looking forward and a looking back, not simply glinting with regret, a leave-taking that's mute but full of the acknowledgement of eyes, that the death drive and the life drive can be one ecstatic rhythm conjoined in a convulsion. Forgetting so much does not matter. What matters is the way conviction is carried across space and time, the way paint fractals travel across space and time to a new life on canvas. Midnight forests, moonlight, scent of rain on dirt paths littered with withered leaves. That ideation should give way to figuration, the cold energy coiled in great cursives. Memory or premonition? Boats are crusted white in winter, the wind whips raising the latest layer of powdery snow. The way the wind shrieks around the scree, lawless, counterpointing the ocean's rhythmic bass. The way the sheet whites and life and death are all over in this utterly indifferent composition. Thank you very much.
Thank you again for coming. Please support Rope It Up Press by taking a look at the broadsides and purchasing them, including this month's broadside and others. Next reading is August 23rd, so I will see you back here for that. Otherwise, I'll be leaving Monday. So long, Stinktown. Population, you.